From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of the Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. How's everybody doing out there? Today I have a great show for you. Something that we're all concerned with, at least if you're listening to the show and you eat. If you eat, you need to listen to the show today. Let me tell you about my guest. Her name is Marion Nessel. She is a Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She's the author of several books, including Food Politics, Safe Food, and What to Eat. She also writes a monthly Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle. She blogs almost every day at foodpolitics.com. Check her out on Facebook. Check her out on Twitter. Her work is excellent. Today we're going to be talking about her book that I will tell you. I love this book. It's called Eat, Drink, Vote. An illustrated guide to food politics. And what I really love about it is there are over 250 cartoons in this book that teach more in those cartoons about what's going on in our food supply and the food politics than most 3-inch books that I've read so far. So without further ado, let me say good morning to Marion. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning.
Marion, what a pleasure reading your book was for me. It was actually fun.
Well, thanks. It was fun to do.
Well, I could tell. What made you decide to do an illustrated guide to food politics?
Well, the project just completely fell in my lap. In my last book, Why Calories Count, there were some cartoons. I always like to use cartoons in books. And you have to get permission to do that. You can't just put them in a book. And in negotiating with the cartoonist group, which owned the copyrights to the cartoons that I wanted to use, it turned out that Sarah Faith, the owner of the group, was familiar with my work and said, you know, I've always wanted to do a book on food politics using our cartoons. And I have always wanted to do a book on food politics using cartoons. I've been collecting them for years. And, of course, the big holdup in using cartoons is you have to pay for them. So here we had a collaboration where there weren't going to be copyright fees because she held the copyrights.
Wow.
So we had a deal. It seemed like a terrific deal, and it was really fun to do. It started out with her sending me 1,100 cartoons.
Wow. That's a whole lot to sift through.
Yeah, well, that was the fun of the book, was picking them out and figuring out which ones to use. Actually, it was one of the big challenges in doing the book. Was sorting through them because so many of them were so good. And then there were other challenges in using them too. So it was a terrific project.
Absolutely. Well, I guess it was meant to be. I mean, talk about harmony and perfection, just the two of them, a perfect blend. You know, for me, knowing that most people's attention spans today are so short, especially, you know, due to the internet and all their different gadgets, I said, you know, a lot of these books that I do read and review are so thick and they're so heavy and they're so complicated that I often wonder, you know, will other people spend the time to read 400 pages of tiny fine print and big words and understand, you know, exactly what they're reading? But when I got your book, which is interesting because it came after I already booked you for the show just because I like your work, I think I read through the whole book in an afternoon. And I said, this is so easy. This is great for, you know, people that work. This is great for children. I mean, this is great for everybody. You know, you can just pick it up and flip through the cartoons and get an education, let alone, you know, the part that you wrote, which is also very easy to get. And I think a lot of people need fast and easy today.
Well, yes, and I was interested in reaching a wider and younger audience than the college students that I usually write for. So this was an opportunity to take the work that I've done over the past 10 or 15 years and summarize it in a very short and accessible, but I hope very accurate way. It's got some end notes and that sort of thing if people want to read more about it. But mostly I let the cartoons do the work. I mean, one of the big challenges in writing the book was that I didn't always agree with the political opinions or views of the cartoonists whose work I wanted to use. And rather than getting into a long discussion about what this view was and what that view was, I could just say what I thought about the issues and then let the cartoons speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, for many, many years now, probably for the whole 14 years I'm doing this show, I've been telling people that the two most important votes they have is to vote with their dollar and to vote with their fork. So when I read that in your book, you know, vote with your fork, I was delighted because I don't know whether people really understand what that means.
And did you notice the cartoon at the end? My portrait cartoon, which says vote with your fork and better yet, vote with your vote. At the last minute, there were a couple of extra pages and they commissioned that cartoon. It's the last page of the
Yes, it's adorable. It's you holding up a fork with a sign on it that says vote. You know, we talk about nutrition and obviously you're an expert in nutrition. And originally, when your PR person contacted me, that's what I thought your book would be about. And then I got the book and started reading, and I love the fact you cover everything, everything from the politics to food, the marketing of food, how difficult it is to get the alphabet agencies that are supposed to let us know whether our food is safe or not to actually do their job. And even cloned animals in our food supply. I was like, wow, this lady didn't leave anything out.
Well, that's because the cartoons did the work. I mean, what I did to do the book was to take those 1,100 cartoons and put them in piles by topic. And then I took the piles and said, okay, what do I need to say to make the cartoons understandable without doing a caption for every single one of them? That would be extremely boring.
Right.
So rather than doing that, I just kind of wrote the background for the cartoons, and the book practically wrote itself. I mean, it really was very, very easy to do, mainly because the cartoons are so strong.
Right. Well, it's also the material you're familiar with. I doubt the average person would say, oh, this book was so easy to put together. It's easy because you know you're, obviously know your material very well. I remember one of my...
for a long time.
I know. So have I. One of the cartoons I really liked, I think, was a man sitting down eating, looked like he was eating fast food, and another man walking in, and I think the bottom of it called it the angina monologue.
Oh, yes.
And I just chuckled out loud.
Yeah.
But
I still look at the cartoons and laugh every time I see them. I think they're really funny.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is a great book to just leave around the house, you know, on a coffee table or something for when your friends come over and they start flipping through it. Because I don't know anybody that doesn't like cartoons.
No, and these are in color, which was, I had no idea that the publisher was going to do them in color. That was really a treat. And I think the book is just gorgeous, and it's small, and it doesn't weigh much, and it doesn't even cost very much.
No, it doesn't, and it's really adorable. You know, here we're living in America where we have a tremendous problem with obesity. I would say that more people are obese than are not. And you do cover that, and in very cute ways, too, with the cartoons. You know, I know you have two supposed terrorists sitting down on a blanket looking and talking to each other. And the radio says, obesity is the number one killer in the U.S. And one of the terrorists says to the other one, forget about a terrorist attack. We'll just wait until Americans eat themselves to death.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I mean, the cartoons can do in just one drawing something that, you know, would just take me pages and pages to explain.
Yeah.
First, you'd have to talk about terrorism, then you'd have to explain about obesity, then you'd have to explain about all that. Anybody can just look at the cartoon and take one glance at it and realize how funny it is.
Absolutely.
It's a different way of thinking about these things. And there are many, many cartoons in the book that I think talked about really complicated issues in ways that were very pointed. It was very, very difficult to choose the cartoons. And the factors that went into that were really quite complicated because the editor wanted to make sure that the cartoons were very tightly linked to the text and illustrated the text in a very tight way. The designer wanted lots of different shapes and sizes to work with. And Sarah Thays, the owner of the cartoonist group, wanted as many cartoonist representatives possible. And I wanted the cartoons to express the complexity of the politics and the importance of the politics and people getting involved in it. So that was sort of the big challenge in putting the book together. And it was, as I said, really a lot of fun to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was like, wow, I hope they have a Facebook page so I can copy these cartoons onto mine every day.
Yeah, that would be great.
I know. People don't think about the politics of food. I don't think people even realize there is such a thing as politics of food. Do you want to explain that, Marion?
It's not the kind of thing that most people think about when they think about food. And when I wrote my book, Food Politics, which came out originally in 2002, and which just came out in a 10th anniversary edition this year, one of the things, the first question I always got asked was, what does food have to do with politics?
Mm.
And I think all you have to do is read the newspaper. We've got a farm bill that Congress seems to be unable to pass. That's politics in action, or inaction, I guess.
Right.
All of the fights over whether how much money food stamp recipients are going to get is about food politics. The FDA is making all these changes to the food labels, and there are lots of industries that are jumping in to try to get the FDA to do what it wants. That's food politics. I can't think of anything about food that isn't a big political issue these days, because anything having to do with food deals with the business of food. It's a $1 trillion-a-year industry. And anytime anybody suggests eating less of something, it's going to hurt that industry. And they're going to be very annoyed about that.
Obviously. You know, of course, what comes to mind is Mayor Bloomberg in New York when he decided to pass a law that they couldn't order drinks, soft drinks, over 16 ounces.
Oh, yeah. People went berserk.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely berserk over it. And that fight is still going on. I mean, the soda industry was so upset about it that it took the city to court, and it's still in the courts. It hasn't been decided yet.
Right, and then you have the other one where they want to, you know, force restaurants to list calorie counts on their food.
Well, that's actually national law.
Mm-hmm.
That started out in 2008 in New York City, and when President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act in 2010, buried in that act was something that made menu labeling and the calorie counts on fast food menus go national. And that was in 2010, and the FDA still hasn't issued the regulations on that because it's being held up politically.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely. I mean, it's my understanding. You know, I've interviewed Ronnie Cummins from Organic Consumers many times, and it was my understanding that the labeling our food law was put into, you know, was legalized in the mid-90s, and yet we still can't get labels on our food. People don't know where their food is coming from, especially meat.
Oh, country of origin labeling, you mean. Oh, yeah, there's an enormous battle about that.
Right, and then you have the battle for, you know, GMOs, labeling the food, whether it's GMOs or not. And, you know, it just seems that, how could it be anything but political? You know, to me, when I hear the term food product, I don't even understand those two words being together.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's either food.
Either it's food or it's not food. What's with product?
Right. It's just such an oxymoron. I'm like, okay, yeah. Food product.
Funny way of looking at it.
Right. If it says it's a food product, I'd be pretty scared of that. You mentioned food stamps. We mentioned obesity. And, of course, I see a huge connection between the two. How could people be starving and still be fat?
Well, that's also about politics, because junk foods are cheaper in the United States than healthier foods. If you look at the Department of Commerce's figures on the cost of fruits and vegetables relative to the cost of processed foods, mm-hmm. the cost of fruits and vegetables has gone up by about 40% since 1980, and the cost of junk foods has gone down by about 30 or 40%. So it's no wonder that poor people eat a lot of junk food. It's what they can afford.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to agree, because, you know, look, I just went shopping yesterday, and I happen to be an organic vegetarian. And
oh dear.
I spent $54 for one bag of groceries, and I was like, holy crap. And I was looking at the woman behind me who looked like she was shopping for an army. Her basket was overflowing with nothing but garbage food. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is the size and shape of her body reflected her cart. And you know, I was glad they, you know, that I didn't have to wait online behind her, but I said to the kid, you know, the kid that was ringing up my stuff, I said, you know, when I was your age, $54 would have bought about 10 bags of groceries.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you would have thought, wow, I just spent, you know, I spent my shopping bill for the entire month, but not anymore. And I do find that a lot of people now are demanding more organic food. Do you think that's politically connected?
Oh, absolutely, because organic production, which has rules about the amount of chemicals that you can use and the kinds of chemicals and the way that plants and animals have to be produced to be certified organic, are an explicit critique of the industrial food system. So anybody who is buying organics is saying, I don't want to buy industrially produced food, and that upsets industrially produced food. You know, people can only eat so much, mm-hmm. and in that sense, it's a zero-sum game. So we have so much food in this country, and it's so overproduced, that any time you choose a food, you're not choosing something else. And so everything is about market share. Mm-hmm. And organics are cutting into the market share of industrial food, even though organics are only a tiny fraction of the total food supply. They're growing. And nothing else is. Mm-hmm. So the industrial food system is very concerned about organics and is trying to discredit it, to do a lot of research to show that it's not particularly healthy or not any healthier than any other kind, and to accuse the people who buy organics of being elitists, mm-hmm. And other kinds of name-calling that goes along with that. And all of that is about market share, and is really pretty easy to understand.
Oh, yeah.
It's about market share.
Right. I mean, I see those articles all the time, and I just laugh at them. You know, yeah. I think there was one maybe a week ago where they were actually trying to say that there's no difference in the nutritional value or anything else between organic food and, you know, machine-produced food. And I just laughed.
Well, the big difference is it doesn't have the same level of pesticides.
And that's a huge difference.
That's been absolutely proven.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. And, well, the other proof is in the taste. You know, when I cook for my friends, they're like totally stymied. I mean, okay, I'm a good cook, but I'm not five-star all the time. And I tell them it's the ingredients that make the difference. You know, bananas still taste like bananas when I was a kid, as long as they're organic.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the locally grown organics are tastier because they don't have to travel as far. I'm a little dubious about those organics that come from New Zealand, but never mind.
Right. Well, you know, I'm lucky enough, and I'm sure a lot of communities now, more so than ever, you know, to have good farmers markets, you know, when the weather is good. And buy local. You know, even buying local, even if it's not organic, is better than what you get in the supermarket.
Oh, I think so.
You know, I tell people, your food's traveled more than you ever will, you know, before it gets to your plate without a passport. Let's get back to, I know a lot of people in this country that are hungry. I know people that are receiving food stamps. And somehow along the line, you're supposed to be able to feed yourself for, I think now with the cut in food stamps, it's something like $185 a month.
Well, that's for a family of how many?
Well, $185 here in Arizona is for one person. If it's a family, I think it's like $235.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I live alone, and okay, I do choose to eat, you know, organic, so it's a little more costly. But really not, because I don't buy meat, and I don't even know what meat costs anymore, because I haven't eaten it in 14 years. But I look at what I spend a week, which is close to $100 for one person. And I don't eat a lot, okay? And I'm like, well, how do they expect anyone to live on $185 a month and eat
healthy?
Well,
nobody ever did. I mean, the food stamp program was never meant to meet the complete nutritional needs of a family for a month. It was always meant to be supplementary. It's called supplemental. I mean, that's why the word supplement is in its name. But the program started at a time when the safety net for the poor was much, much greater and involved many other programs, including welfare of one kind or another. Now all of those have closed, and food stamps are all that's left.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you look at this country and you say, wow, you know, they may not be talking about it, but we're in a very similar state to the Great Depression.
It certainly feels that way to a lot of people. And I personally know lots of people who are out of work who've been looking for jobs for months and can't find one, or if they do find a job, it's a job at a salary that is much, much, much lower than what they were getting before.
Oh, I totally agree. I think Obama came out in his latest speech and said that for every job that opens in this country, there are three people that are applying for it.
Yeah, that too.
All right. So, you know, there's, we're in some pretty dire straits. And yet, we have that polarity in this country. You have the super well-fed, and you have the starving. And that shouldn't be the case, because I'm sure we have enough food to go around. So why?
There's no question about that. Absolutely none. It's the way it's distributed that's a problem.
Well, isn't that political?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We're back into food politics again.
You know, it's interesting. While I was reading your book, I had gone to the grocery store and I needed lemon juice. Okay. And I looked in all the aisles where anybody with a brain would think lemon juice was, you know, the juice aisle for one, the condiment aisle. And I just gave up. And when I went to the register, the girl said, "Did you find everything you were looking for?" And I says, "Actually, no, I was looking for lemon juice and I couldn't find it." And she gave me the aisle number, and she says, "It's all the way down on the bottom, like almost on the floor." Okay.
All right.
And I said, okay. So something simple like lemon juice, which is usually pretty cheap to buy, is so hard to find in the store, but all these watered, sugared down juices were right at your face level.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, absolutely. How can people not see marketing to us as political?
Because I don't think people see marketing at all. It's just part of the landscape, and you don't notice it, and you're not supposed to notice it. I mean, that's how marketing works. It's supposed to slip below the radar of critical thinking. And nobody is supposed to notice that companies are spending billions of dollars a year to try to get you to buy their products. Remember, we have a food supply that has too much food in it. And therefore, it's very competitive. We probably have twice the amount of food available in this country that the population needs on average. And even if a lot of it is wasted, which is a big issue these days, there's still more than people need. So that makes the food system enormously competitive.
Well, then, you know, it makes it hard for me to understand how so many food banks are running out of food. You know, why aren't they taking that extra food and donating it?
Because they don't have that much extra food anymore. As the food industry's inventory procedures have gotten better and better. They're much more able to very closely estimate what it is they're going to be able to sell within their sell-by days. Mm-hmm. And they just don't have that much to donate.
Right. Well, you know, you look at how much food gets wasted every day. I'm sure plenty gets wasted, just, you know, what stores and restaurants throw away at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, they have to. So, they can't keep it because of safety reasons. And
right.
A lot of them have made arrangements to donate it. But you really don't want a society that's based on donated food. That's something that will never stop. Mm-hmm. What you really want is you want to construct a society where people can earn their own livings and afford to buy their own food.
Right, or grow their own food. And yet,
you
did talk about, you know, home gardens. And I, of course, had a home garden last summer and supplemented it with the farmer's market down the street. But in a lot of cities and towns now, they've made it illegal to have a home garden.
Oh, really? Well, I'm sure that will change.
Mm.
That will change as there's an enormous movement in this country for urban gardening and other kinds of things like that. It's happening everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I think that will change.
Well, I hope so. I certainly hope so. We talk about, you know, people get confused. You know, I hear so many people talking about different diets that they're on. You know, the paleo diet, they're on the Atkins diet, they're on this some kind of beach diet, you know, thinking they're eating the Mediterranean diet, and you look at the government's food pyramid. Do you think this is all deliberate to confuse people into what healthy eating really is?
No, I think it's done deliberately to try to protect the company's interest or the food industry's interest. Their interest is in selling more food, not less.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they are very concerned that no government agency ever suggests eating less of their products. And they're vigilant in making sure that no federal agency ever does. So this isn't a great conspiracy or anything that people need to think that they're, you know, these companies are evil. They're not. They're just doing this as the normal course of doing business in this country.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember when Michelle Obama planted that organic garden outside the White House and the flack
I thought it was a terrific idea.
I did too, but she surely got a lot of flack from the food industry for that.
Yeah, of course she did, and that was because, as I already said, organics are an explicit critique of the industrial food system,
mm-hmm.
and they're considered elitist. So for the White House to do this left them open to charges. It was not a neutral act.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it was a courageous act.
I thought it was great, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, no, it was terrific.
And then when she started talking about, you know, school lunches and, you know, getting our kids to eat healthier, the vicious personal attacks on Michelle were off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's overweight.
Anytime
you do
anything like that, because again, the food industry's job is to sell more food, not less. And if the lunch standards in schools change, then there will be industries that are hurt by that because they will not be able to sell their junk foods in schools anymore.
Right. Well, didn't they classify pizza as a vegetable in school?
Well, Congress did that.
Oh.
I mean, here again, this is another situation where politics comes into it. The Department of Agriculture's regulations for the new school lunch rules said that there had to be a certain amount of tomato sauce before you could count it as a vegetable serving.
Mm-hmm.
And the pizza industry went to Congress and got Congress to pass a law that said that the Department of Agriculture couldn't put any volume restrictions on tomato sauce.
Right.
Now, this is a Congress that cannot pass a farm bill, but they were able to do that.
I know. It's really insane when you think about it. Meanwhile, you know, the people that suffer are our children. You know, I live right down the street from a high school. And I watch these kids walk into school in the morning. And, you know, besides the fact that they all walk to school like the living dead, which somehow I can't blame them for, I actually get a kick out of it, I do see the obesity just walking by. And it seems the poorer you are, the more obesity you find. How does that happen?
Well, again, this is because we have a situation in this country in which junk foods are cheaper than healthier foods.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and then people are trained. You know, I don't remember if it was in your book or not, the cartoon that said, if the food has an advertisement, don't eat it. And look at how they pitch this garbage, not just to our kids, because believe me, my adult friends tell me if they're watching TV and they see somebody eating something, they want that too.
Mm-hmm. Well, advertising works. They wouldn't do it if it didn't act, if it didn't work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's for sure. So I try to stay away from it. I'm sure you've seen the poster, Marion, where I think it's Ron Paul questioning it, where there's two pictures. One is that, and of course it's at a fast food place. One is the burger and fries, which is probably $1.99. And on the other side is the salad, which is $4.99. And it says, can somebody explain this?
Yeah, well, it's hard to explain unless you understand how farm subsidies work and a lot of other very arcane details of our food policy system.
Well, you know, my explanation, I always post it in the comment, is one is food and one is not. The salad is real food.
That's one way to look at it.
Right, the salad is real food. The other thing is something that's not going to rot if you leave it on your counter for a year. It's still going to look the same.
Right.
You know, even ants won't eat that stuff. What is it? Marion, we're going to go to a short break. I'm going to ask my listeners, of course, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Wow. One solid hour of commercial-free information thanks to you. The person who wants truth has the integrity and understanding to support it with your donation and subscription. Maria believes people can handle the truth and delivers it tirelessly with those with ears to listen. 14 years on the net. Won't you take a moment right now to commit to a subscription of your choice at www.maria.net. That's M-E-R-I-A.net. Over 1,100 hours of pure education all in one place, 24/7 and all downloadable. Knowledge is power. Sharing that knowledge is wisdom. Together we can change the world and create real hope. Now let's get back to the Maria Heller Show.
Okay, welcome back to the show. My guest is Marion Nessel. We're talking about her excellent book, Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. It's available right here. Click on through, buy the book. This is a great book for everyone to have. You know how I tend to rate my books here on the show. I give this one a 10, and it's a book that, too bad, is not inside every schoolhouse in America. That would be a really good thing. Marion? Before the break, we were talking a little bit about, you know, obesity, the school, you know, our school foods. You know, a lot of times I think when we get something exposed on the internet through social media, that seems to be making a political difference. What do you think?
Well, social media is a new force in American society, and certainly there have been examples where individuals have hit on food policy issues or food politics issues and made an enormous difference by exposing them on social media. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of the blogger who started talking about pink slime in school meat, mm-hmm. and got the companies to stop making it and to at least label it so the schools would know what they were getting when they were buying this product.
Exactly. Well, I remember when those pictures went out online, and I think a lot of fast food restaurants were using that pink slime, too. It created quite the stir. So I think this is another place where we might actually have a vote that counts. You know, as I just noticed the stories that go viral on social media are the ones that get the attention.
Mm-hmm, they do. I mean, they make news, and hundreds of thousands of people sign up, and this is a very good way to have your voice heard, even if you're not a particularly political person.
No, exactly. Well, it's kind of works the same as those cartoons in your book. when it comes down to food issues, and people don't realize food also includes, you know, their pet food, their alcoholic beverages, and, you know, their meat, and when everything included, who really gets to make those decisions?
Well, usually the makers of the foods, and the food industry will say, well, we only give consumers what they want, and if consumers don't buy products, then we won't make them. But that's not really true, because it's complicated by the advertising and marketing that goes behind so many of these products.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, they can sell you pretty much ice in the winter with good advertising. I see that a lot when it comes to all these drugs and all these drug ads on TV. You know,
well, it works the same way as food. Food is no different than any other industry in that way, except that we have to eat to live.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, but you look at that, I think more so in the past 2 years, I've noticed a lot more food recalls, a lot more people getting sick, salmonella, E. coli, et cetera. And, you know, when they trace the companies, whether it's peanut butter or meat, oh, they kind of had an inkling that was happening, but they released the food anyway.
Oh, yeah, there have been some really horrifying examples. I'm not sure they're going up. They're certainly being better publicized. And there have been some really shocking examples of bad behavior in some food companies. And that bad behavior, of course, is the basis of the Food Safety Modernization Act that Congress passed a few years ago. And the FDA is just now starting to come out with the regulations that will put some rules into effect that will require companies to do a much, much better job of producing food safely.
Right. Well, I remember, I don't know, maybe it was a year or so ago when all those dogs started getting sick and dying from bad dog food.
Well, you know, I have a couple of books on pet food. I don't know if you know that.
But, no, I don't.
I have a book called Feed Your Pet Right and another one called Pet Food Politics, which was an analysis of the pet food recall of 2007 when melamine from China was getting into pet food and killing a lot of dogs and cats.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that got, that seemed to get more Americans' attention than the poison in human food.
Well, people do love their pets.
That's for sure. They do spend quite a bit of money on it. They do. What an industry. But you have, you know,
yeah,
some...
And Feed Your Pet Right is an analysis of the pet food industry, even though the title doesn't really suggest that, but that's really what it is.
Right. Well, what do you think about genetically modified food?
I think they should be labeled.
Well, I would think at the least...
It would solve a lot of problems.
Right. Well, one of my favorite cartoons in the book is the lady shopping, and she's got an article in her cart on genetically modified food. She's looking in the frozen food case, and some of the brands, one is Uncle Ben's, one is Mrs. Paul's, and the one she's looking at is Dr. Jekyll's.
Yes. Right. Well, there's, nobody can tell whether the foods are genetically modified or not because they're not labeled. And that was a decision that the FDA made back in the 1990s. I thought it was a mistake then, and I still think it was a mistake. Because if it had been labeled, people would have a choice about whether to buy it or not, and it might have toned down some of the paranoia that people feel about the fact that the food industry is trying to hide something from them.
Well, the fact that they won't label it makes them look guilty as sin.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, that should be all the answer.
Why they can't see that is beyond me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But, you know, today, you know, they've got all these frankenfoods, you know, and, you know, you do cover in your book, and it's just to show how up-to-date it is, you cover, you know, what happened during the Gulf oil spill to, you know, seafood. You talk about the radioactivity from Fukushima in the Pacific. You know, from what I'm reading, you know, there hasn't been a tuna tested on the, from the Pacific that isn't radioactive.
Well, these cartoons are current, and therefore the book is current. And as I said, the cartoons governed what the book was about, and they're very up-to-date because the cartoonists who are represented in the book are political cartoonists who are writing for daily newspapers and magazines, the ones that still exist.
Mm-hmm.
And their just right on top of these issues, and many of them have a terrific sense of humor, which makes what they're writing about and drawing about much easier to take, and many of them are really spectacularly good artists, and I just think some of the drawings are really beautiful.
Absolutely. And, you know, you also talked about cloned animals being in the food supply.
Ah, yes.
When I tell people they're already in the food supply, you know, my attitude is, and maybe it's because I'm from Brooklyn, I don't know, but my attitude is if they're talking about passing a law, that means they've already been doing it. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. It's not the cloned animals themselves, it's the offspring of cloned animals that are in the food supply. Nobody is talking about it or writing about it very much, and it's very hard to know whether it's the kind of thing that anybody should be concerned about. But, you know, nobody's really paying much attention to it or a lot of other things that are going on these days.
Right, exactly. Well, because they're busy working three jobs to make the money they made 20 years ago to try to put food on their table.
Right, and the one regulatory agency that is supposed to be in charge of this, the FDA, has had its funding taken away so systematically over the last 20 years that it hardly has anybody to do any of the work that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the fact that the consumer doesn't even get a choice to whether it's genetically modified, to whether it's cloned animals, to who knows what country this, you know, piece of fish came from, is pretty serious to me, you know, because, you know, people say, well, you know, my grandparents ate like this, they lived to be 95, and I'm like, our food supply is nothing like what my grandparents ate.
Yeah, it's changed a lot, and in some ways for the better. You can get food in supermarkets these days that really wasn't available 20 years ago. I think it's one of the great achievements of the food movement is to get fresher, healthier foods into supermarkets in a way that never used to be there. But there's lots more work to do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, we all like the convenience and we all like the choice. But, you know, when it comes to labeling, I think, look, the companies obviously know. No one's going to buy their products if they're labeled.
Well, they think that's the case. I don't know whether that's the case or not.
Truthfully.
That experiment hasn't been done yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you're probably right, because the more they expose about fast food, you know, they put calorie counts on your, you know, $2 for $1 burgers, and I'm like, God, what kind of quality could that possibly be? People don't care. You know, they don't even look at the calorie count.
Some people do. Those who are educated and can afford it do.
Mm-hmm.
And they care a lot. And, you know, there's all this controversy over menu labeling in New York City, where it's been in place for 6 years now, and the studies show that overall it hasn't made much difference in calorie consumption from fast food. But if you break the data down into looking at whether people actually looked at the calorie counts or not, you do see differences. And I can tell you that menu labeling affects what I buy.
Oh, it certainly does the same for me. And, you know, even more than the calorie count, you know, not to just single out one company in particular, but I was shopping and I, we'd all like to be lazy and pop something frozen out for dinner. So I said, well, let me check out these Lean Cuisines or whatever it is my friends, you know, keep in the house in a pinch if they have anything vegetarian. And I looked at one of their little dinners, and the calorie count was great. Okay, it was very low-cal. But when I looked at the sodium count, it was 890, and I was like, holy crap! I was like, holy crap, I blow up for 3 days on probably 5 pounds of water weight.
that's 2 grams of salt right there.
I know, I was like stunned.
Yes.
So, you know, it's an interesting read. Now, what about microbes in the food supply? I was reading your book, and I want to just read a little piece of it on page 114. It says, and you're talking about problems with food and safety regulation. You say the CDC estimated foodborne microbial illnesses affected 48,000 people a year and caused 128,000 hospitalizations and 3,000 deaths. This should be like front page.
That's their estimate, and it's probably probably an underestimate.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you talk about fecal contamination. People don't realize that there are limits for fecal contamination and other disgusting things that are okay to be in your food supply.
Yeah, there are. It's pretty, I mean, food is a living organism. It's pretty hard to keep it sterile, and bacteria are everywhere and they're very small. But you really only have to worry about the bacteria that cause illness. Mm-hmm. And those are the E. coli's and the Listeria's and the toxic salmonella's are the bad ones that you worry about. Otherwise, it's just a little dirt never hurt anybody.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid, like in the 50s, we had separate stores for everything you had to buy. There were no grocery stores.
Right.
And I remember going to the produce store for my grandmother, and no matter how much she washed that produce, soil, real dirt, would continue to fall off. And when she boiled or steamed her vegetables, she would actually take a ladle and scoop the bugs off the top of the water. So I said, wow, I guess we couldn't get more organic than that.
Yeah, I mean, vegetables grow in dirt. Let's be real about this.
Exactly.
Dirt is dirty, by definition. But that's not what you worry about. What you worry about is these toxic organisms that come from animals, farm animals of one kind or another, and that have gotten into the water supply or the ground supply, and then get into vegetables or on vegetables in some way. And the really big change in the food safety system has been that vegetables have become an enormous problem. It used to be it was just meat. Uh-huh. Now it's vegetables as well. And there's hardly anything in the food supply that hasn't been associated with some kind of food safety outbreak problem because the companies are sloppy in the way that they're producing food, and they're not going to produce it safely unless they have to, because it's going to cost them more money.
Exactly. But, you know, I always think about, you know, how much money does it cost these companies when they have to do a recall? Well, they have a bunch of lawsuits.
Yeah, but their calculation on it is that in the long run, that's cheaper than having to take safety precautions in the first place. I think that's ridiculous thinking. Mm. And I once talked to the people at Earthbound Farms, the big organic producer in California, and they were, one of their products was responsible for the spinach E. coli outbreak of 2006. Mm-hmm. And they vowed that, and it was a terrible outbreak and people died. It was really, really terrible. And they felt awful about it and said that nothing like that was ever going to happen again. And they wanted to stay in business and they wanted to make sure it never happened again. And they recruited a very eminent microbiologist to come in and redo their safety systems. They now have a system where things are tested when they come in, clearly identified and tested when they come in, and they're tested before they go out. Mm-hmm. And they haven't had any problems since. And I said, okay, this is fabulous. How much does it cost you? And they said, it costs us a penny a box.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, the public can afford this.
Right, for a penny, I'll get them 2 pennies.
Yeah, well, the public can afford this, mm-hmm, because their volume is so great that the cost is distributed over a very, very large number of products. And it's just, it shouldn't be a cost issue. So that's why the Food Safety Modernization Act is so important, and it's so important to get it implemented as soon as possible.
Right.
So that companies will be required to produce food safely, and you won't have these situations where you've got somebody who's a really bad apple, who knew that there was salmonella in the peanuts and just kept sending it out until he found a testing company that said, oh, these are clean.
Right. And shipped the peanut butter out anyway.
And shipped them out and made an awful lot of people sick.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, you know, everybody ate peanut butter, okay?
Right.
Everybody. It was a staple, especially in a poor neighborhood. You know, you took peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to school.
Right.
And I don't recall children having such peanut allergies ever until genetically modified food.
No, I don't think it has to do with genetic modification because peanuts aren't genetically modified. And nobody really knows why allergies are increasing. There are lots and lots of hypotheses, but nobody really knows.
Well, maybe it's pesticides.
Except they really are increasing.
It's disturbing to me. It's like, wow, kids can't be kids on so many levels compared to when I was a kid.
On so many levels. Well, the whole raising of children has changed a lot.
Well, yeah, that I agree with. You do have a couple of chapters towards the end of the book, which I was glad you included, on how to fix the food system, people working towards fixing the food system. So it's not all doom and gloom, is it?
Oh, no, I don't think so at all. I mean, for one thing, I teach college students, and there are hordes of college students throughout the country who are interested in working on food issues, on changing the food system, and in getting really involved in food advocacy, and that's very exciting.
Yes, it has to be, and I do know, you know, from all my vegetarian contacts, that's really where a lot of the increase in people choosing to be vegetarian is happening, with college kids.
Yeah, I mean, they start looking at the food system and thinking, gee, the way we raise animals is pretty awful, and the waste and the ecological waste in the animal system is awful, and they decide either to become vegetarians or quasi-vegetarians. And just, if they're going to eat meat, they want their meat, their animals at least humanely raised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I'm glad to see it. You know, some days I say, wow, I never thought I'd live to see the day, but it's amazing how many things you can live to see if you live long enough. The food movement, do you think that this is something that's going to continue to grow?
Oh, I think so. All signs point to more and more people getting involved in it. And, you know, my particular indicator of it is that we at NYU, New York University, where I teach, started programs in food studies in 1996. And at the time, there was a gastronomy program at Boston University, and that was the only other one that existed in the entire country. And now practically every college and every university has some version of a food studies program at the undergraduate level, master's and doctoral levels. And, you know, we produce doctoral students who have degrees in food studies, and so are other places. And at first we were distressed at the competition. We thought, how are we going to keep our program going in the middle of all this competition? And we said, wait a minute, this is jobs for our doctoral students. And it is.
Oh, that's fabulous. That's really fabulous. Well, Marion, I do want to thank you so much for joining me today and for sending me this book. It's a keeper, so I may lend it out, but it's going to stay in my house.
Well, thanks so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Same here. You take good care now.
All right,
bye-bye. Bye. And again, you can check out Marion's work. Let me give you a couple of websites for her. foodpolitics.com and the name of the book, eatdrinkvote.com. It really is a book that you won't have to do much work convincing your friends to pay attention to. And it's a very easy education. The cartoons are spectacular, and I've always loved cartoons. And her writing makes it so easy. This can't get any easier than this particular book. Anyway, thanks for supporting the show, and get your friends to turn on to the show. Okay, let this be the year that the show really grows. The more of us that know, the quicker we can change the madness out there. Of course, I'll be back tomorrow with the news. And again, thank you for supporting the show. See you guys then. And remember, you do vote with your fork. Make no mistake about it. So vote for health.
Thank you for listening and supporting The Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information, all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.